You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrick. Coming up, we'll ask you to share your favorite hobby and what it means to you. First, we're kicking off a series of interviews with the candidates running to become Wisconsin's next Supreme Court Justice. When the primary election on February 20th rolls around, three candidates will be on the ballot. Only two will move on to the general election in April. All candidates are vying to replace Justice Michael Gableman, who announced last year that he would step down after his current 10-year term ends. It's the first Wisconsin Supreme Court race without an incumbent since 2007, and the stakes are high. We're talking with each of the candidates this week. We'll start with Michael Skrenok. He's a circuit court judge for Sauk County and one of the three candidates running for Wisconsin Supreme Court. Judge Skrenok, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, why are you running for a seat on Wisconsin's highest court?
You know, I'm running because for two reasons. First, I care deeply about Wisconsin. I was born and raised here and raised my family here. But also I care deeply about the rule of law. And I believe strongly that it's the role of the court to interpret and apply the law as written, based not on the justice's personal or political beliefs, but based on the statutes and the Constitution. And when I saw my two opponents announce their candidacies, I was not satisfied that either one of them share my view of the court's role, and that certainly has borne itself out as the campaign has proceeded. And so I believe strongly that we need our next justice to be one that is committed unwaveringly to following the rule of law.
We'll get more into the politics issue in a little bit. I just want to hear more about your experience and why you think it makes you the most qualified candidate for this position.
You know, I have the broadest experience, and I think it is the most full experience for preparing someone to serve on our state's highest court. When you think of the types of cases that the court hears, at the very core of most of the cases that our Supreme Court hears is a tension between private interests and society's interests, as those societal interests are reflected in government regulations. And so I spent the first nearly 12 years of my career working in local government as a finance director and city administrator. And in those roles, my job was to assist city councils and mayors, first to understand the limits of their lawful authority, and then to accomplish their goals within the confines of that authority. Then for 8 years, after I went to law school, got my degree, I worked for 8 years as a private attorney. And most of my work there was done with private interests, private businesses, and individuals in their interactions with government. And so I really have spent most of my career wrestling with that tension between private interests and society's interests. And I've done so from both sides of the equation. So I understand the perspective of government and what motivates government officials in trying to get their job done. And I understand it from the perspective of private interests as well. But now as a judge, and Governor Walker appointed me in 2015 to the circuit court here in Sauk County. I grew up in Baraboo, so I'm serving in my hometown. As a judge now, I'm not an advocate for either party in any case that comes before me. My fidelity now is to the law and to the law alone. But I bring to the bench that vast experience. I also have, I believe, the most experience among the candidates in working in our appellate courts. I worked on 13 different cases in our state appellate court system. A lot of those cases ended up at the state Supreme Court. And the work that was done as an attorney in researching those cases and drafting briefs is in large respects the same task that a Supreme Court justice must do when dealing with those same cases. And that is to do research on what the law says, and it's detailed, lengthy, I call it deep dive legal research, to do that research and try to understand what does the law say about these complex questions. And so I've done that work as an attorney in the context of briefing cases to the Court of Appeals and our state Supreme Court. And so I'm very well prepared to hit the ground running on the Supreme Court doing that very same work.
One issue that's come up at the state Supreme Court is the question of when it's appropriate or even necessary for a justice to recuse him or herself. What's your standard for recusal?
Yeah, it's a very important question. And at the very foundation of our judicial system, which is an integral part of the government that we have governing ourselves, at the very foundation of our judicial system is the notion and the importance of having a fair and impartial judiciary. And so for me as a judge right now in Sauk County and for every justice on our Supreme Court, for every case that comes in front of them, each individual judge and justice has to determine whether there's any reason why that individual cannot sit on the case and hear the case, because for some reason they cannot be fair and impartial. And so that, there could be any number of reasons. It could be that you have too close of a personal connection or a feeling about the issues in the case. It could be that you have too close of a personal connection to the parties in the case. There are any number of reasons why a judge or justice may need to get off the case. Now, the difficulty and an important feature in our Supreme Court is that we have absolutely no provision for substitute justices. We have 7 Supreme Court justices, and if one of them needs to get off a case for any reason, we have 6. And if 2 of them need to get off for any reason, we have 5. We have no provision for substitutes. And as a court of last resort, which is what our Supreme Court is for any case dealing with state law issues, it's really important both to the parties and to the public that we have a full bench every chance that we can, that we have all 7 justices there deciding the case. And so the issue of recusal is, quite frankly, a lot easier for me now on the circuit court, because we have hundreds of circuit court judges, and we can go through substitutions and reassignments until we find a judge that can sit on the case without any problem. We don't have that opportunity at the Supreme Court. So that the questions about recusal are much more complex and tricky at the Supreme Court, and quite frankly, more important, because those cases are determining what the law is that applies statewide and controls me as a circuit court judge and controls our court of appeals as well.
One question that's come up is a campaign donation, maybe a substantial campaign donation by a party in a case, something that should lead a judge to recuse him or herself? You're running in a race that'll cost some money. You'll have donors. Would you have to recuse yourself if and when those donors are arguing a case?
Yeah, and at the outer boundaries, the answer to that question is has to be yes. Our U.S. Supreme Court has determined that in a case coming out of West Virginia. They identified what our Constitution requires just in terms of a situation where a party could be so directly involved in a campaign for justice that due process would require a justice to step aside from the case. So the U.S. Supreme Court has identified really what's the upper limit, not in terms of a dollar figure, but in terms of the types of considerations that the justice ought to consider, whether due process would require recusal. And then below that, again, it gets at the core of our recusal rule is a determination by the individual justice whether or not they can remain impartial. And so some of the things that the U.S. Supreme Court identified were, how does that contribution, that individual contribution, compare to all of the funds that were raised by the campaign or spent in the race? Because you could have a number that on its face looks like a very large number, but in reality is a drop in the bucket to the total cost of the campaign. And the Supreme Court said, that's relevant. You look at that. So I have not set a dollar figure that would sort of be a trigger, because every recusal question has to be considered on a case-by-case basis. And the other thing that's important for the citizens to consider is that we have significant First Amendment concerns when you're talking about participation in an election. And we've chosen an elected judiciary here in Wisconsin. It's always been our tradition. And what I'm concerned with, particularly with respect to the proposed rule that was floated earlier and was rejected by our Supreme Court, is I think there's a danger if you set just an arbitrary threshold and say this is the dollar figure. What you then run the risk of is taking individuals or groups that have an interest in participating in the electoral process and participating in the campaign that's going on right now, and having them sit on the sidelines out of concern that a justice may need to recuse themselves over this arbitrary rule. And I think that's a significant concern that the people ought to be concerned about, that we not use an arbitrary recusal rule to stifle activity during an active campaign.
want to get into the politics issue a little more now. As often happens in these races, we have Democratic elected officials supporting one or two different candidates during the primary anyway, and Republicans lining up for one candidate, you in this case. Does the fact that partisan support goes different ways say something about your politics, the way you are anticipated to rule on issues?
Well, it shouldn't, and the reason it shouldn't is because I have been very clear from day one about what my judicial philosophy is. And my judicial philosophy is that the role of a justice is to do the research. And Justice Wilcox told me this. He said, this is what I did when I was on the court. You do your research, and you go where the law takes you. You do not have a case come to you and say, oh, I see this. I see how I want this case to come out. Decide the outcome on the front end, and then just find some legal path of reasoning to get to the outcome. And so I am committed, and I do commit to the people of Wisconsin, that I would, at every opportunity, set aside my personal feelings about a case or an issue and decide the case solely based on the law as I find it. I think that's critically important. Now, it shouldn't be surprising that people either like or dislike that judicial philosophy. And so I don't think that people should be surprised that people are lining up behind my candidacy, including, you know, I've got the endorsement of a bipartisan majority of the sheriffs all across the state. I've been endorsed by the Wisconsin Realtors Association. And those groups understand that that the only way that we have stability in the law is when justices exercise the self-restraint necessary to set aside their personal feelings and not decide cases based on the way the justices want the case to come out, but based on the law, so that we can have certainty in the law. And I think that's really important. The other thing is that I believe strongly in justices recognizing and respecting the separation of powers. And what I mean by that is that when a law comes to the court and the question is this law unconstitutional, the only question, the only analysis that the court ought to be giving that is whether or not when the legislature passed that law and the governor signed it, did they exceed some constitutional boundary? The question is not, is this good public policy? And sometimes people get confused by that, and they want to use the courts as a tool to overturn what they view as bad public policy decisions made by those other two branches. Well, at the core, at the foundation of our government, is an expectation that the legislature and the governor are going to set policy for the state. That's their job. And it's why you have lobbying, and it's why you have robust campaigns that deal with issues for those seats. When it gets to the court, the question is not whether it was good policy. The question is, did those other two branches act lawfully? And that, quite frankly, is not a partisan question or a partisan issue. My judicial philosophy does not change depending on what party is in control of the legislature or what party has control of the governor's office. My judicial philosophy remains the same, and that is no matter who's in control of those other two branches, they get to set policy for the state. It's not the court's role to decide they made a bad policy choice and thus overturn it.
We'll leave it there for now. Judge Skronach, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Michael Skronach is a Sauk County Circuit Court judge and one of three candidates running for Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk to Madison-based attorney Tim Burns, who's running for the seat, and the third candidate, Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Rebecca Dallet, joins us on Thursday. If you miss any of these interviews, we'll have them all posted online at wisconsinvote.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A couple weeks back here on Central Time, we talked about hobbies and the role they play in our lives and how they can help us be happier and shape our identity outside of our work, outside of our employment. We asked you to share your hobby of choice during the show and the role it played in your life. We got a huge response, more of your calls than we could actually take in the time allotted. So we wanted to set aside another chance for you to share your hobby. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your hobby? What do you get out of it? Have you shared it with others? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. J. Carlisle Larson is in search of a new hobby. Hey, JC.
Hey, yeah, I am looking for a hobby.
And you were inspired by Central Time.
I was, yes. Oh, my gosh.
For a change.
Yeah, you know, the show that I work on every day. Oops, you didn't hear me say that. No, just kidding. You know, I am in my 30s. I want to be able to do something outside of work that isn't strictly just work, because I'm worried that I'm getting a little bit boring. I need something to say. I also do this.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have any hobbies. I'm open to hobby suggestions. I have some ideas. I did talk to Sarah Jacobs in our membership department recently about how I wanted to get into ceramics, and I still haven't done that. So yeah, I mean, maybe one of the questions out there too is, how do you get into hobbies and maintain them? So maybe some of our callers have some answers for that as well.
Well, in Wisconsin, much of Wisconsin is littered with pottery studios and classes. That could be an easy one. We heard from Jason Butler, assistant to the director of radio here. He says, gardening mostly found me. That's his hobby. I grew up mostly in the desert and so never really got gardening. It was when I came to Wisconsin that I learned that, by golly, seeds planted to the ground come right up and grow. Winter, maybe not the best time to pick up that hobby.
Maybe not the best hobby. I also have tried gardening, and I am terrible at it. It's just, I mean, our board op, Michelle, gave me a plant, and it's the only one I've ever kept alive. So that is, but I've also managed to kill 2 spider plants, which seems impossible. So I don't really have a green thumb.
Yeah, those are hard to take out, even if you want to.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 as we talk about hobbies. Cindy starts us off in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. I have many hobbies, but one of my hobbies that I enjoy doing is attending fundraising events.
Really?
And I do that is because it's a win-win. It's something I get out of it, and of course I'm benefiting, you know, a group that's raising money. So.
Okay. And are these, I mean, are they fun to be at, apart from the feeling that, you know, your money is going toward a good cause? Do you find them enjoyable?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them are very enjoyable. And I used to attend probably one a week, but a lot of them, unfortunately, are getting kind of expensive, so I've had to cut back a little bit. But that's what I like to do.
Interesting. Cindy, thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, that's, and people have talked about this, hobbies, if you're doing something to help other people, that can be good. And there's also a social element there, as our guest talked about that being a good part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a cool aspect. It's fun hearing when people say that they, you know, do good, but also get good out of it, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it sounds like Cindy's on the right path there.
Thanks for starting us off, Cindy. We'll go next to Susan on the line in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hello.
What are your hobbies, Susan?
My hobby is camping. I love to camp. I have a camper that I go out of state and all over. And it's adventurous and it's relaxing.
Great. And is this something you do on your own or with family?
Pretty much on my own, or sometimes with one of my sisters.
All right, Susan, thanks a lot. That's camping, obviously, a big hobby in Wisconsin. I don't do a lot of camping. I haven't a lot in my life.
I think it's up there with the ceramic studios being everywhere. We have such beautiful parks throughout the state that sometimes I feel bad when I don't go and visit them, like Devil's Lake. When it's there, it's really not that far away from where I live. So I kind of don't have an excuse.
Susan, thanks a lot. We're talking about hobbies and what we get out of them. You can share your hobby and what it means to you at 800-642-1234. What do you do? Why do you do it? Billy is with us next in Wausau. Billy, hi.
Hi, my family and I snowshoe race in the winter. And when I say race, I'm not a runner. I waddle slowly behind the runner. But it's a really good way of getting outside and participating in an activity with a really nice group of welcoming people and seeing different trails around our state through the winter.
Billy, have you snowshoed your whole life, or is this something you took up recently?
I took this up about 7 years ago attending a race in Perkinstown, Wisconsin, and it was such fun that I've done it every season since, and now I'm up to about 10 races a year.
And you mentioned people welcoming you. Is this, you know, people are happy to pass on this pastime of theirs and recruit new people?
I think it's that, in addition to people just exuding friendship at these events. They're there to cheer on one another, whether they're very serious 10K runners who are finishing a race in 40 minutes, or someone like myself who's just bringing young nieces and nephews out and enjoying the day.
Billy, thanks a lot. There you go, JC. Get those snowshoes on.
Yeah, that sounds really fun, too. As someone who is trying to run more and also loves snowshoeing, that finding the best of both worlds could be a nice way to have that be maybe a seasonal hobby.
Thanks a lot, Billy. We heard from Paul Breen, our colleague here. He's a genealogy geek. He says, I remember my dad getting some basic info from his aunt when Paul was a teenager, spending increasingly more time on it as he ages. So that's actually, we've got some genealogists in my family too. That's a good one. And John, just across the lobby from us there at Audience Services, wanted to shout out to all the adults with nerdy hobbies like myself who play board games, role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons, and trading card games like Magic the Gathering. Jen says, I've been playing since I was 9 or 10, haven't stopped since. I have a lot of those nerdy hobbies myself. Back to our callers now. Rebecca is on the line in Monroe. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your hobby, Rebecca?
Well, I went to a family reunion back in 2004, and now I'm addicted to doing family research and building a family tree.
And, you know, I've got family members I mentioned who do this, and they spend time, if they're in the right place, taking pictures at graveyards or getting rubbings. Do you do any of that kind of thing?
I go to graveyards. I've gone to courthouses. I've gone to meet people that I am related to that I never met before. I've gone to Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, all over the place.
Wow. Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that. Time for one more call. Ryan with us in Mishicot. Ryan, hi.
Hi.
What's your hobby, Ryan?
I'm gearing up for maple syrup banger pretty soon here, but then after the snow melts, I go mushroom hunting down in the woods.
Those are great hobbies because you get to do the thing and then you get to eat it, too.
Exactly, yeah.
Ryan, thank you so much. So your course is clear, JC.
Absolutely.
You make pottery out of which
pottery.
You eat the maple syrup or
I
mushrooms.
I mean, that sounds great. I mean, I'll totally do that.
So are you going to try something? Let's get a new second month of New Year resolution.
Okay.
You're going to try a new hobby.
I think I'm going to try a new hobby and maybe we can check back in since people have a lot to say about how they spend their free time and
one
what they
new hobby
get
each
joy.
Week.
Oh gosh. Can you imagine? I become so interesting with all of my new hobbies.
All right. You're already plenty interesting, JC. Keep sharing your hobbies. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Now, Larry Nassar, former doctor for Michigan State University and the U.S. gymnastics team, has been given decades-long prison sentences after pleading guilty to multiple counts of sexually abusing young athletes during medical treatments. Here's Judge Rosemary Aquilina talking to Nassar at his sentencing last week.
As much as it was my honor and privilege to hear the sister survivors, it is my honor and privilege to sentence you. Because, sir, you do not deserve to walk outside of a prison ever again.
Nearly 260 girls and women have reported that Nassar abused them, and many of them gave victim statements at his sentencing hearings. But for over 20 years, allegations of Nassar's abuse were brushed off by the U.S. Gymnastics Organization, Michigan State, and law enforcement. Has many people turning their attention to the sport as a whole, pushing for changes that will make it safer and more accountable to young athletes. Jennifer Say was the 1986 U.S. Gymnastics champion, and she's the author of Chalked Up, My Life in Elite Gymnastics. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
In writing and talking about this, Jennifer, you've been making the case that this is not a problem with one doctor who did a lot of horrible things. You see a much wider institutional problem. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in saying that we don't have a one-guy problem, which I've been saying, that is not at all minimizing mm-hmm. how horrible this one guy is. Because it was beyond my wildest imagination, and I imagined things that were pretty bad and experienced things to be pretty bad. But, you know, the point I've been making pretty publicly since my book came out in 2008, so that's 10 years ago, is that there is a widespread culture of abuse in the sport. And in fact, abuse of all varieties, emotional, physical, and as we're seeing now, sexual, is so widespread that it's almost invisible. You almost don't see it. And when there's a culture created where these young athletes, and they are very young in many instances, you know, I walked into a gym for the first time when I was 6 years old, and I was training, you know, nearly 30, 40 hours a week by the time I was 10. When you have a situation where obedience, blind obedience is expected, and abuse is just part of the culture. And when I say abuse, I mean things like, you know, the rate of eating disorders is incredibly high in the sport. These kids are weighed many times a day. They're told they're fat when they're hungry. They train on broken bones and injuries. They're told they're lazy if they're not willing to get back out there. And so you learn not to trust your own perception of the world when that's the environment you're growing up in at a very young age. And so when someone like Nasser comes along and perpetrates these vile crimes, he can say to these young children, this isn't, you're not uncomfortable. This is a medical treatment. And the child already does not trust her own perception of the world. So she's much more likely to be convinced and to at least try to believe him. So, you know, when I say that this culture, it was almost inevitable that something this horrific was going to happen when you have a culture that requires such blind obedience and where abuse is so widespread.
I want to give a listen to Rachel Den Hollander, one of the first women to go public with the abuse she suffered, talking about these wider problems after Nasser's sentencing.
We would not be here had the adults in authority done what they should have done 20 years ago. We have taken care of one perpetrator. We have not taken care of the systems that allowed him to flourish for 20 years.
And as we heard from victims of Nasser, as you wrote about in your own book, people are not encouraged to come forward with problems. When people come forward with accusations, there's a very hostile response, a very angry response, not at the perpetrator, but the person raising the problem.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I think, you know, I mentioned it's a culture of obedience and a culture of abuse. It's also a culture of money and medals. And these institutions, MSU, the USAG, and the USOC, protected their reputations, and that took precedence over the protection of these young athletes, who are children, let's not forget, they are children. And they were making money off of this notion that we had these hardworking American young athletes who were dedicated and motivated on their own, and we were different than those Eastern Bloc countries who built champions, world champions, with abusive tactics. We were different than that. We did it the right way. That was the image we presented. We presented the image that we could win and do it all the right way. And that was a lie at the end of the day. But that's the image we presented that enabled us to bring in sponsors and money. And so the medals were absolutely critical. It was critical to keep winning those medals, but it was also critical to maintain that ideal that we were doing this with our values intact. And so, you know, any expression or reporting of any of these, you know, horrific facts, that person was then discredited. And, you know, I experienced that myself. I was not a victim of Nasser, but wrote a book in 2008, was absolutely discredited and called a liar and an opportunist. And after me, Dominique Moceanu, who was a 1996 gold medalist, wrote a book that was very critical of the Carollis, who were running the national program for many, many years, and many believe were complicit in this Nasser situation. She was also discredited. So different woman, same playbook. We were all discredited because it interfered with that image that was so necessary to present.
Talking to Jennifer Say, 1986 U.S. gymnastics champion, author of the book Chalked Up, My Life in Elite Gymnastics, talking about the Larry Nasser case, sentencing this week, and wider issues of abuse in gymnastics, betrayal of trust in many ways, and accountability. Jennifer, what has to happen to save, I guess, the sport, but more importantly, the athletes, the kids who are going into gymnastics? What needs to happen to make sure these things don't happen?
Well, I mean, a lot has changed in the last few months, really, right? So we're the broader cultural context of Me Too has happened. So we're all inclined now to listen. Secondly, as it pertains to the Nassar case in particular, based on the victim impact statements in Lansing, 156 women spoke there, and then more in Eaton County, we truly came to understand the depth of the emotional harm that was experienced by these women, and that is prompting the demand for change. I think the first thing we have to do is just recognize that a dramatic cultural shift is required. We need to set a new vision for this organization. Culture change is really hard. You can't just make a quick declaration. This has been the culture for decades. You know, as I've said, this has gone back, this culture of abuse, till when I can remember it back into the early mid-70s when I started the sport. So, you know, we're talking about four decades, if not more. This is going to be incredibly hard work. But the first thing we need to do is recognize that a dramatic culture shift is possible. We need the Safe Sport Act to pass. This is the bill that Dianne Feinstein brought forward, which criminalizes non-reporting. You know, believe it or not, a coach, a gym owner, a member of USA Gymnastics has not been and is not still required to report suspected abuse. They are not mandatory reporters like teachers and social workers and pediatricians. This is the primary feature of the Safe Sport Act, and that we need that to pass. But again, that's not going to drive the broader cultural change. We need the USOC and the USAG to do that, and they need new rules and protocols put in place. They need to, again, reinforce this mandatory reporting. They need to establish a database of complaints about coaches, so when a gym is about to hire a coach, they can check and see if there's been problems in the past. They need a hotline to report abuse. And almost most importantly, I would say there needs to be significant education of coaches. Right now, there's really no requirement for a coach. They don't have any sort of child safety training. There's really nothing of any significance. You need more training to become a yoga teacher or to become a Girl Scout leader. There needs to be education around child safety for coaches. And the kids and the parents also need education about what is okay, what is not okay, in terms of questionable behaviors, emotional, physical, as well as sexual abuse. And that needs to be ongoing education, and that needs to be a program that is enacted by the USAG in all member clubs. And those clubs need to adhere to that or they will no longer be members.
It sounds like another change from how you were talking about coaching is there's almost this mentality that the coach is God. I mean, the kid doesn't question the coach. The parents can't question the coach. Whatever they do, however harsh it seems, it's for the good of the athlete is the attitude. Is that something that needs to change?
That's absolutely correct, and that's the culture change I'm talking about. You really feel that you can't question the coach or you'll be punished. You won't be on the team. You won't get the spot that you want. You won't get the extra training hours. You won't. There's a whole host of things. And, you know, you can enter the sport as sort of a relatively normal person with a ton of perspective, but a little bit of talent and a little bit of opportunity, and you can easily get sucked into this vortex of this very abusive and destructive environment. I think the best parents in the world get sucked into it. And, you know, it's important to remember that the parents were prevented from even being in the gyms, and they weren't allowed at these training camps, so they weren't even really seeing what was going on. Now, yes, as a parent, I would question why I wasn't allowed to be there, but the kids were then, you know, trained to be very obedient, and they wouldn't go home and tell their parents what was happening. And everyone essentially is afraid to rock the boat because they don't want their child to miss out on this opportunity.
We're talking to Jennifer Say, author and former U.S. gymnastics champion, about what can change in sports organizations, gymnastics in particular, to prevent the abuse of young athletes. This after the sentencing of the doctor who had committed years, Larry Nassar, of cases of abuse against young athletes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change in sports, in gymnastics, in the people who run these organizations and coaches? If you're the parent of an athlete or an athlete yourself, what conversations are you having now about these topics? If you're a coach, what needs to change for you and your colleagues. And if you are a gymnast or have been yourself, we'd love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with Jennifer Say, author of Chalked Up, My Life in Elite Gymnastics. She's a former U.S. gymnastics champion. But what needs to change in sports to protect young athletes from abuse? And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching this Larry Nassar case progress? He was sentenced to decades in prison, multiple sentences of decades in prison for years and years of abuse of young athletes in his care. How do you think amateur sports can be more responsive to allegations of abuse when they come up? If you've been an athlete yourself, did you see things that could have been done differently to respond to inappropriate behavior? Do we need to change the culture around competition and coaching and winning? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You were talking earlier, Jennifer, about reporting of incidents of abuse. And thanks to the reporting from the Indianapolis Star, which really cracked a lot of this story open, there were cases where a gym owner might call the National Gymnastics Group and say, hey, there's this coach, he's bragging about abusing kids potentially. I want to report that to you. And they didn't take that seriously. They said, well, if it isn't a signed complaint from an athlete or their parent, it's unverified. We're not going to pursue it. Is that right?
That is correct. The first piece printed in the Indy Star was about the chronic mishandling of cases of abuse. When they were reported to the USAG, they were dismissed, discouraged, and ultimately these complaints were, sort of buried in a drawer somewhere. And there were tens of reports. I mean, the numbers were in the 50s or 60s. So there was just this constant discouragement. And again, that's part of that culture of obedience and that protection of reputation above all else, reputation of the sport, of the club. And if you are an organization that takes athlete and child safety and child welfare seriously and makes that your number one priority, this would never have happened. They would have taken those reports seriously. They would have reported them to the authorities. They've proven themselves incapable of doing so, and that is why the Feinstein Act needs to pass.
Let's talk about personnel changes. People at the top have left the organization. Do you think a lot more people need to leave who are at some stage in this complicit or covering up cases of abuse?
Yeah, I suspect so, and there will be independent investigations both at MSU and I think USAG as well. Yes, the board has all resigned under pressure from the USOC, and the president and CEO resigned, quite a while back at this point. But, I think there were plenty of people within the organization doing his bidding, and that needs to be looked at. People have asked me and said to me, why didn't these girls speak up? Why didn't they? And what we know now is they did, time and again, 97, 98, 2004, 2014, 2015. They spoke up, they said something, and they were dismissed. And these reports were buried or mishandled or not taken seriously. And anyone who did that needs to be held accountable.
I want to bring on our callers now. Heidi is with us in Wausau. Heidi, hello.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to comment, as being a former gymnast myself, that I really think the sport needs to consider a different type of uniform for gymnasts. I believe that something more modest would be just so beneficial to these young individuals and children who are wearing next to nothing sometimes, and I just think it is not fair to them.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Jennifer, what do you think?
There are people that say that, and I think it certainly has merit. I don't think it's the panacea, and I don't think it necessarily solves the problem, but I see the value in it for sure.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Go next to Tom on the line in Eau Claire. Tom, hi.
Hi. Hey, I'm really agreeing with what your guest is saying here, and it is a cultural change that is needed if we're going to correct these problems. And it's got to start at the elementary, the junior high, and the high school level. We see it all over the country where athletic departments absolutely control a school district. They have that much power. And unfortunately, it only gets worse when an athlete starts thinking about advancing to the collegiate level or the professional or Olympic level. It just grows and grows. And I think to correct the problem, we have to go back to the junior high and the high schools and truly put athletics in their place, which is to be an extracurricular sport. And when you can get it back to that level, then the next thing we have to talk about is you're talking about mandatory reporting. As far as I know, in every state in the country, a school teacher is a mandatory reporter, and coaches are school teachers. They're on the same budget.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of that applies to school sports. Jennifer, a lot of what we're talking about in gymnastics doesn't happen in the context of a school district, right? It would be at a club.
That's correct. These private clubs exist outside of the school district. Most, if not all, of these coaches, you know, are not school teachers, have no sort of accreditation in that area. And even if they were teachers, in this particular function as a club coach, they don't have that same sort of accountability. So, you know, that's the problem. I agree with everything the caller said, of course. But the sort of the problem and the dirty little secret, if you will, is that all of this private club network across the country has essentially existed outside of those laws and regulations. And so, you know, it's the perfect haven for a pedophile. Sadly, they can, you know, be around a lot of young children alone, private coaching sessions, as the previous caller said, you know, around athletes that are, you know, minimally clothed, and they really don't have any oversight or obligation to child welfare other than, you know, what ethics would demand, and we've seen that hasn't really taken precedence.
We're next to Steve on the line in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi. The solution to me is the grandfather of four granddaughters, two of whom are in gymnastics. It's fairly simple. Young women need to be believed when they come forward. They do so at great risk to themselves, and not being believed, this compounds what is already a very difficult situation.
Steve, thanks a lot for that call. And Jennifer, that what Steve is calling for there is, it sounds like, the opposite of what happened. Teens weren't believed.
That's right. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, a lot has changed. The broader cultural context has changed with the Me Too movement. And it sort of dictated that we listen to women and, in this case, children. And I think the other thing that has changed since we watched the victim impact statements in Lansing is not only we believed them and listened to them, but we truly understood with our hearts the depth of the harm that happened. And so we are now motivated to change. But I will say, you know, this case has been active for a long time, quite a while before Me Too started, and it wasn't generating any headlines. So it is this broader cultural context and that change, I think, that has really brought this to the fore.
Jennifer, very briefly, I mean, are you hoping there's a new generation of coaches, maybe the people who survived this victimization in the first place, who can turn things around for the future?
I mean, I love the sport. I grew up doing the sport. I started when I was 6, and I did it till I was 18. There's so much good in it. And if you can sort of view child development and self-esteem building and all of those things through the lens of sport, it's all very positive. But we need to rebuild it from the ground up. And all of those methods of coaching that have been acceptable in the past need to go away. And for all the coaches that are feeling defensive and nervous out there, they need to take a good, long, hard look at how they've been coaching for the last years and decades.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jennifer Say, former U.S. gymnastics champion, author of Chalked Up, My Life in Elite Gymnastics. She joined us to talk about the case of former athletic doctor Larry Nassar and how sports organizations can protect young athletes from sexual assault and other forms of abuse.